Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Suzanne E. Scoggins to discuss her book, Policing China, Street-Level Cops in the Shadow of Protest, published by Cornell University Press in 2021. China has the reputation for being a strong security state. After the pro-democracy Tiananmen protests, the Chinese government moved to increase stability maintenance. And that approach is reflected in today's suppression of social unrest in Xinjiang, where somewhere between 800,000 and 2 million members of the Uyghur minority have been interned in camps. Throughout the country, the government has maintained stability by installing millions of cameras. The Chinese and international press emphasize these actions, projecting a view of China as a strong security state. But my guest today argues that the decision to prioritize stability maintenance comes at the expense of everyday policing. In remarkable interviews with police officers and analysis of policing journal articles, she assesses resource allocation, police reforms, and structural patterns of control to find a weak police force unable to protect citizens against violent crime. Policing China provides a more accurate understanding of how the police function in China and how they can be so ineffective at everyday crime management while still being very good at stability maintenance. Dr. Suzanne E. Scoggins is an assistant professor of political science and director of Asian studies at Clark University. She's also a Public Intellectuals Program, or PIP, fellow at the National Committee on United States-China Relations, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the New Books Network.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
So many of the authors listening know that research doesn't go as planned, that you can find something you don't expect, or the research environment, especially in an authoritarian country like China, might not allow you to get the data that you want. You went to China expecting to write about effective police practices, and I'm wondering if we can start off by talking about how you went to China, what you were expecting to find, and how this project changed once you got there.
Sure. So there were so many false starts, I think, with this project. I did as much research as I could before I went into the field. I read everything there was, but it's really a limited, there's limited literature on this. There's a little bit in criminology, some history going back. And based on that, I knew that the police had really limited resources, but I also knew that crime was low. And looking at all the official statistics, I thought there might be some noise there. I thought there might be some underreporting, but I was really expecting to find this story of effective policing. And when I started talking to police officers, when I finally got police officers to talk to me, because that in itself is another story of just, you know, struggle and, you know, thinking that my pre-existing contacts would be very, very happy to talk about their jobs when in fact many of them were unable to do so. When I finally, you know, got to the business of sitting down with police officers and I asked them about effective policing, I would just get these blank stares. And you know, they would ask me like, what do you mean? Or some of them would laugh. And, you know, at first I thought that I wasn't asking the question in the right way. And I would go back to my dictionary and I would talk to my friends and it just wasn't there. There is no effective policing. I thought that there would be this story of decentralization and you know, people really like these officers really finding a path forward in the face of these limited resources. And that just wasn't the case. And instead I heard story after story about inefficiency and, you know, reforms that were working against them and, you know, higher ups that weren't listening and problems that were on the ground and really made them unable to do their jobs. And I said, okay, so this is the story I have to follow. This is what's really important about policing and everything that I thought I expected to find and really had kind of hoped to find, because it's a better story to tell, right? Effective policing, especially in an authoritarian regime, is a better story to tell. It's a safer story in many ways. I realized that I had to tell this entire other story that looks at stability maintenance as the success, but essentially every other type of policing responding to crime as a failure.
Okay, you say a safer story to tell. Why would it be a safer story to tell?
It's a little bit more positive, right? You can talk to someone. So when I first did some pre-dissertation interviews, like way back in 2009, I wanted to talk just about protest policing, and I realized very quickly that this made people nervous. You know, talking to police officers, talking to state agents of any kind in an authoritarian regime is difficult, and you know, there's a lot of distrust, and you know, that's one of the reasons why it took me so long. I spent 22 months on this project over a period of, you know, spanning over a decade. And I had hoped to kind of find a toehold in that, something that was an area that was permissible, that wasn't just about protest. But in the end, that wasn't the story. It wasn't the story to tell. It wasn't the story that was interesting. And it didn't reflect the reality of their lives on the ground. And so I wrote this book instead.
So we're going to get to the book. That's going to be most of this. But a lot of people listening do interviews, and a lot of people do interviews in places where it's difficult, where the people being interviewed have to think very carefully about their own safety and the repercussions that they might suffer with their colleagues or with the government or in their communities. So just say a little bit about working in China. And I'm also wondering about, well, I guess I'll ask you about your next project later, but about how you're thinking about returning to China, because that seems to be a real problem as China scholars are thinking about their next projects. But for the moment, what were some of the challenges to interviewing in China and with this particular group, police officers?
Sure. I think it's important just to say from the outset that this is not the kind of project that I could do now. Right. This is a project that happened in a very particular moment, in a very particular time and space, and even then it wasn't easy. Even under a period that was relatively more permissive and more open for foreign scholars, I spent a lot of time with human subjects, right, trying to figure out how I could do this in a way that was safe for my interviewees, that was safe for me. Spent a lot of time as other China scholars do in protecting my data and carrying my files around on a little flash drive that I hid, right, so that nothing would ever be revealed, and trying to really take as many steps as possible, and also to give people an out, right, at any point. And you know, at several points in the research, I had people say, "I can't talk to you about this," or, you know, this is not possible. We have to cancel the interview. And then even after the fact, I had people come back and say, whatever we talked about can't go on the record. And so you really have to be so careful and so respectful of the fact that this is people's lives. And, you know, while it's a research project and it's important and it's your book, it's not as important as their job and their well-being. And so it's really crucial to respect the constraints of human subjects and to be careful in the planning, right? You can't just do what you want to do. It's very important.
Well, let's start with trying to get to what the sort of the main questions were and the issue. You begin the book with a story of Xiao Hu and a crime that committed that may not be familiar to everybody listening. So can you start with that incident and how it affected the people in China and maybe why you opened the book with that story?
Yeah, so it took me a while to figure out how I wanted to start the book, and I really wanted to give people a sense of the stakes, because you're talking about poor policing, you're talking about ineffective policing, but it's hard to know what that means, right? Especially coming for an American audience, coming from a place where we have over policing, particularly of Black and Brown communities, we have under policing in China, and there are different consequences for that. So I begin the book with the story of Xiaohu, who was a 17-year-old grocery store clerk, and she apparently reportedly had met a boyfriend online who shows up at the grocery store acting strangely. Some of her colleagues they call the cops. The cops come. The man has left, and so they think everything's okay. But then the man who had purchased a knife in the first visit comes back, and he immediately starts stabbing Xiaohu. And there's video cameras of all footage of all of this. It's kind of grainy, but it's still online now. And so you see, they call the cops back. The cops come in, and they don't know what to do. And it's literally like you or I were to try to stop a murder, right? Like we just don't quite know what to do. And they stop at the door. They pause, and she's being stabbed, and she's calling out for help. And at one point, they pick up a plastic stool and they throw it at the attacker. Like they just don't know what to do. And people are urging them to come in to help her to stop. And it's only when essentially she collapses and probably the point at which she dies that the officers come in and the attacker starts to attack himself and he falls on the ground, that the police are able to use their pepper spray and to subdue him. And it's just this terrible, terrible story and this grisly footage and such a plain example of police in action, and people just erupt, right? It gets reported by the local news. It starts going across the country, and people are just so frustrated, because what are the police for? If the police can't stop you from being murdered, like if they can't stop that attacker, then what are they doing? What have they been training for? What's our public funding like going to, right? And so there was a lot of frustration with that. And of course, there was an investigation. And this is why, this is really why I start the book with a story, because the investigation finds that the police had done no wrong, that there was no protocol, that they had to stop this murder, and that they had done that they got to keep their jobs, and one of them had even been involved in training. And that's just the perfect story for what effective policing looks like. Someone gets hurt, there's an investigation, they've done no wrong because the protocols are underdeveloped, and people just have to live with this reality. And this is really, in terms of worst case scenario, this is what ineffective policing looks like, where the police are unable to do the job that we expect them to do in society.
Okay, you've mentioned a lot about their training, and it's an incredible opening. It's funny, I read a lot of books now, and I read a lot of openings, and I'm more and more conscious of how difficult it is to pick something that really will resonate throughout the rest of the book, that sets up the problem and the question that the book is answering. And this is an incredible opening, you know, grisly and very troubling, but also one that sort of allows you to see this through the eyes of the people in China and their own disgust and upset with it, which I actually think really enhances it. So it's not just a sort of a scholarly example, but also one that's sort of coming from the place, which I loved. But it does, everything that you've said leads to like, so they weren't doing anything wrong because they didn't have the training that would have allowed them to do this. On the other hand, the kind of footage that we normally see that's not grainy, that is in Chinese press, the American press, European press, all over the world's press, is not that kind of a Chinese police officer. It's one that's more aggressive. It's we're all familiar with the Tiananmen Square footage. We're constantly fed a kind of a narrative in which the police in China are aggressive, prepared, and ruthless in some sense, in not hesitant in the way that you were just describing. So let's like back up. How do you become a police officer in China, and what does their training look like? What are they told is their job?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. A lot of the older police officers were actually members of the army, and that's the older guard that's now retiring. And then sort of in the middle, people who are sort of in middle aged, a little bit younger, many of them went to policing colleges or policing high schools, even policing middle schools. They went in knowing this was a profession that was for them. And now the police force is trying to reach out and get more university graduates who had not been through those policing programs, those policing schools, to try to get a diversification. But it's still not a very good job. This is really a lower level civil servant position. So this is much better than something like the Chengguan, where they're not official public, they're not official civil servants, but they call it an iron rice bowl, essentially, because you know that once you have the job, it's your job for life, and it can be very that notwithstanding the fact that it's a difficult job, it's still desirable for a considerable group of individuals, and they have to take an exam, they have to do an interview. We know that their social connections make a difference in that interview, but not the exam. And sometimes they have to start out way in the countryside before they move to the city. So they might be from a city, but they have to work in the countryside in a paichusuo, which is like a local station, for any number of years. And sometimes they even have to work as contract police before they become an official police. But once they're able to get that iron rice bowl, they can stay as long as they want, although a lot of them do burn out, and they have much higher rates of suicide, liver disease, a lot of health problems from the stresses of working in the job. So it's desirable, but it's not that desirable. And the ministry officials are thinking about how do they keep people on the force who they've already sort of trained and brought up. And the training itself is fairly interesting. There's training at the police colleges, but a lot of this and a lot of the annual training that they're required to do is really ideological in nature, right? So they're talking about socialism with communist character with Chinese characteristics and the importance of upholding the party's goals and of serving the people. And there's not a lot of actual training that we would consider to be useful. So, learning how to shoot firearms is a relatively minor part of their training. Learning about forensics for many, I've been told by many officers, is non-existent, right? They just don't have that kind of technical training of what do you do when X happens. It's really more that the training programs, in particular the annual training that they do, if they do it at all, because some of them do it and some of them don't. Some of them they don't have those opportunities that they're supposed to. It's mandated, but it's not available to everyone. They often describe it as a time for them to rest and relax and put their heads down and just kind of take a break from the stress of the job. And that shows, right? That's also feeding into this problem of poor policing. They're being trained on ideology and not these technical matters that would help them do a better job and help them, respond to crimes like what happened to Xiaohu.
So is any of that related to funding? Are they underfunded and this is a response to that? Or is this actually what it is that is the declared mission for the police, or what it is supposed to look like? And is there a disjuncture there?
Yeah, so that's a good question. It is underfunding, and particularly historically, it's underfunding. But in around 2013, 2014, and that range, we start to see a lot more funding going toward the police. So in general, the stations are underfunded at the local level, but the ministry is able to push more funding from the local level that comes from local governments remains underfunded. But the funding that comes from the central government through the ministry, they've been able to increase those amounts that go to stations. A lot of those a lot of that funding goes toward things like equipment purchases. So these cameras that you're seeing, the police body cameras, that's not really going to training because there continues to be a strong need and preference for this ideological training, right? This is part of like what it means to be in the civil service, what it means. And this is not unique to policing. This happens in other bureaucracies as well. You know, you really have to bring people into the fold and make sure they understand the party goals and stress the importance of that, even when it comes at the expense of the technical details that would be so important for civil servants like police officers who are, you know, grappling every day with very, very, very difficult problems with the public.
Has this always been the case in China? And how long has it been the case in China that this is how police are arranged through the civil service with these priorities and this kind of training and this kind of funding?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I don't know how far we want to go back, but the policing of China 1949 into the communist era, you know, came through the Republican era policing, right? That started in the big cities, that started in places like Shanghai, and was really focused on crime management. But once the communists took over, it became also focusing on rooting out counter-revolutionaries, right? Doing some political work. And then there's this big break during the Cultural Revolution because the police were not the arm of the Red Army, right? The police were actually the target of the Red Army. And so many officers stopped doing their jobs. They left. Many of them were even killed in large cities like Beijing. There was a number of officers who were killed. And so policing just kind of falls apart in the 60s and 70s. And it's this lost era of policing. And all of that has to be rebuilt in the 1980s, starting in 1978 from the reform period. They have to rebuild policing, bring people back. They have to hire officers. And so that's when a lot of people who had been working in the army, in the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, they are no longer needed and they're getting older. And so they enter the police force. And it took a long time to really routinize that, which is interesting because when these police stations, you know, were first sort of rebanding and repopulating, they had a lot of power. They had a lot of local control, and the ministry saw that as a threat because they couldn't control them, right? If they're walking around like the sheriff in town doing whatever they want, the ministry can't control them. And so you see this process of centralization that begins in the late 1980s and really becomes more concrete by 1995 with the police law, where they're trying to make sure that there are more rules, there are more regulations, there's standards for recruitment, and eventually they take their guns away, which is interesting as well to try to control them. So all of this idea of the ideology, yes, it does go back to the Mao era, right? Like this is sort of classic communist training, but it serves a modern purpose, which is to professionalize the force, to centralize the force as much as possible, and to manage any sort of local despots or local abuse of power that they can, because ultimately the party's goal is to stay in command, to stay in control, and they have to have control over the local forces, the local government forces, if they're going to do that. And by, you know, continuing this ideological training, it helps them achieve that goal.
Oh, that's great! Thanks so much for going that far back. I know that that's hard to do very, very briefly, but that was beautiful and really useful for putting this in context and understanding where some of the mission, for lack of a better word, or goals come from. China's a huge country. There's an enormous amount of local variation, even though it's centrally controlled. What does police, are there differences across China in the police, and how did you you know, since it is such a big country and one researcher can't go and interview police in every single place, how did you decide where to go and how to set up, I think it's 115 people that you talk to who are in the police. How did you, so number one, what are some of the variations across the country? And number two, how did you think about those variations as you were setting up the research design?
Yeah. So I like to call this policing in between, because I really couldn't get to the places where I initially thought that I could get. I thought that I could do research in Beijing and in Shanghai and in big cities. I knew that I could never do research in places like Xinjiang. I knew that anywhere that was just too politically sensitive, I would not be able to do that. And so I think the findings of the book are limited in that regard, that it's about policing in smaller cities and, you know, still like relatively large cities, but not the biggest, like most developed cities, and not the places like in Xinjiang where we see the opposite phenomenon of over-policing, particularly of the members of the weaker group. And this of course was an iterative process, right? I started with contacts that I had, people that I had met before I started my PhD, people that I met after I started my PhD, friends of friends. I went around asking everyone essentially that I knew, you know, do you know any police officers who might be willing to talk to a foreigner? And do you think that they would be, that would be an okay thing for them to do? And if so, would you introduce me? And so it was a very classic snowball sampling in the worst and the best sense of the term, right? You can't just draw a map of China and randomly select the police stations where you want to go and knock on their door and say, "Hi, I'm a foreign researcher. Will you let me interview, you know, X number of your officers?" You really have to go through social connections, and that guided my research. It guided the sites that I chose, the places I was able to go, and the places that were off limits to me. And sometimes I knew people for years, and they knew exactly what I was doing. And then one day they decide, "Hey, I've got a cousin, right? Would you like to go to this city?" And I said, "Yes, I would love to go to this city. I'd love to talk to your cousin. Are you sure it's okay?" And they said, "Yes." And so I had a number of research sites that opened up that way. Retrospectively, it actually worked out okay. I have a decent economic variation. I went to some larger cities. I went to some smaller cities. There's geographic variation as well, which is nice. But all of this was completely, entirely dependent on my contacts and on the willingness of people to feel like they could talk. And one of the reasons why Beijing wasn't on that list, I finally did talk to some officers, including one officer who was quite high up in the Beijing police, years after I had completed the bulk of the research. The reason is there's a lot of political sensitivity in Beijing and a lot of concern. And so even though sort of my best contacts were in Beijing initially starting out, they were the ones who just didn't feel comfortable and, you know, were happy to meet for coffee, but just were not able to talk about their work. And so that political sensitivity, even during a time, because a lot of the research was conducted in 2011 and 2012, right before Xi Jinping takes power. Even during that time that was relatively open, this kind of topic was off limits in certain cities, and I had to be mindful of that.
In a country as large as China, there would be no way to do this. And I actually appreciated in the book in particular and thought it was very useful the way that you grapple with this, the way you're very transparent about how you did it, and as you are here too, but you go into further detail, and it is interesting because as scholars from the foreign scholars have to build networks, and you can't build a network everywhere. And even if you were native to a place, you might have more contacts, but you still couldn't cover a place like China. So I think it's an important part of all research, but it's a particular issue for a country as big and diverse, yeah, and as difficult to work in because of the authoritarian nature of the regime, China. So I love how you did that in the book. I think it's very, very useful for any author or reader to understand that piece.
Thank you.
So you talk a lot in the book about how the, you know, the, as you've said, the ineffectiveness of the police, but you also talk about how they are punished, how they are controlled, you know, how it is that they are, in a sense, policed themselves. So could you talk a little bit about what it is the police fear if they behave in certain ways, whether they fear dismissal? I mean, you said that it's a, you know, it's an iron rice bowl, but do they also have to live in fear that they, in fact, could lose this job or lose their privilege?
Yeah, so in a number of ways, the police are in sort of a tight spot. And the first one is sort of the ministry's goals of professionalization and rule adherence. And there is always an off chance that the ministry, either the central ministry or the provincial ministry, will send a team down to the local station and find them doing something they're not supposed to be doing, and then they get fired. And so, you know, for example, police officers are not, for over a decade now, they're not allowed to drink on the job. They're not allowed to drink at lunch. But that's very much a integral part of police culture for decades. And it was difficult for officers to stop doing that. And there was one location where I visited and some police officers had been fired because the central ministry came in and they were essentially like in the station drunk and asleep. Of course, they get fired for a lot of other things as well. Things like if corruption is found, or if there are certain ties that, you know, to local crime that are you know, that are not allowed by the ministry, maybe by the local governments, but not the ministry, then they can be subject to being fired. But the real sort of systemic, those kind of visits don't happen all the time. That's relatively infrequent because just like there are manpower restrictions for the local police, like the local level police, there are also manpower restrictions for the provincial and the central ministries. Where they really get into a tight spot is when there's what I call shared control. There's certain crimes that are considered sort of medium priority, not to the extent of stability maintenance and protest control, which is high priority, but these medium priority crimes, things like the drug trade, right, where the ministry is interested and invested in making sure that they're implementing central government reforms and expectations. And the local governments may have their own preferences and their own you know, social connections. Oftentimes this is completely under the table, but they have certain, you know, rules for or expectations of local police behavior so that their associates or their friends don't get caught up in anything, in any sort of investigation, despite the fact that they're doing illegal things. This kind of shared control environment can really put the local police in a tough spot. And in particular, I talk about one example that I think is really interesting in the book, and that's the issue of unannounced raids. So the ministry wants to do unannounced raids. So if there's a place where people are suspected of buying and selling and using drugs, then those places should be raided, right? And the local police don't want to do that for a number of reasons. They don't want to do that because perhaps local government pressures, because, you know, someone might get caught up who they don't want to be caught up in the investigation. But also it helped the local police kind of know where the drug use was. And in one particular research site, they were forced by, you know, ministry officials coming in and forcing them to do these unannounced raids. They were forced to change their habit of essentially calling up the KTV club and saying, hey, we're going to be there 11 p.m. on Saturday night. Make sure everything is all good. They had to stop doing that. And it ended up pushing the drug users in the city underground to places where they couldn't find them. And this was very frustrating for the local police because they felt like they had lost that knowledge of what was happening. And if they were going to go into a private residence or into a small hotel, that was going to be a much more dangerous situation than if they were able to call ahead and say, hey, we're coming Friday night, make sure everything's okay. So it does put them, you know, sometimes in a tight spot when this control of local governments and the ministry is being exerted at the same time.
So We've covered, so this is a very complicated book that we're trying to sort of jam into a very short podcast. In the book, you really focus, and you've focused in the interview on, you know, three particular areas. You know, one is resource allocation, the other is police reform, and then also these structural patterns of control. I want to talk a bit about the implications of your findings, because that's also part of the book. Yeah. But before we do, have we covered everything that you'd like to cover in the main argument, or are there some things that you would like to add?
So I think it's important to point out that we're not crazy thinking that China has a strong security state, right? Like, we're not, that's not coming out of nowhere. This is definitely an image that the state has been projecting, and in one particular area is quite successful. And when I structure the book and I was thinking about how I wanted to divide up the chapters and focus on resources and focus on reforms and patterns of control, it was always with a mind of bifurcating stability maintenance, protest control, and everything else, right? Other types of policing, because they really are doing quite a good job. And all of the stories of inefficiency and training, all of that is just does a complete 180 when it comes to stability maintenance. There's training for stability maintenance. There's coordination, right? They have someone to call. They call the People's Armed Police when things get out of control. They have really concrete protocols. They have funding, specifically stability maintenance funds, that can be used to not just put out a protest, but also to bring someone back who's trying to go and protest in Beijing or in a provincial capital. All the stories of the underfunding and the inefficient reforms, all of that is quite different for stability maintenance, which is the story that we hear, right? This is what we see. This is what we read about in the New York Times and the BBC. And it's you really can't get another picture of policing unless you go out and you talk to police officers. And that was really the turning point for me in the research when I sat down with enough individuals and understood, oh, these two issues are being treated completely differently. And this is because of priorities, but it's also because of limited resources, right? Because the ministry officials, when you talk to ministry officials at the central and even the provincial level, they know about these problems. They understand that, you know, the training is inadequate, that the funding needs to be redirected, that people need to be paid for their overtime work, which they're not being paid for, but they just don't have enough resources to direct to these other, you know, problems of crime control. And as a result, they focus on stability maintenance and these sort of medium priority issues when they have to, and they kind of limp along for the rest of the areas of policing, which is to the detriment of everyone, right? To the officers, to the public, to anyone who's living the realities of what poor policing looks like on the ground in China.
So you mentioned the perception, what you read in the New York Times, and honestly, I can see that there is an incentive for some of the international journalism to focus on the authoritarian nature of the Chinese state, how it is they're suppressing the people. But internal to China, you said that there is a lot of reaction to Shouhu's attack. Does there continue to be internal dissent? Dissent is probably the wrong word, but criticism of the police and demand from the citizenry that there should be reforms to the police. Like, what is the state of reform within China?
Yeah, so the book itself, this particular book is not able to really gauge the public reaction. And so that's my next project, right? I really want to understand what's happening. But what I do talk about in the book that I think is important for setting the stage of sort of the implications of this and what it all means is that a large number of the protest events, it's nearly a quarter, I think it's 22.5% of protest events, the last time they reported it, which, you know, again, that it's been many years now, it's almost a decade ago, the last time the state reported it in 2012, nearly a quarter of the protest events were caused by police-society conflict, broadly defined. Right. And so there's censorship. So when anything really bad, like the Xiaohu story happens, there's censorship and there's an attempt to control that narrative. But the implication is that it's driving some of these other conflicts, that it's actually this ineffective policing and this poor policing is actually feeding into protest, which is the thing that they care the most about, right? That they're trying to control. And so you have this circular loop of dissatisfaction and anger and frustration when police do things because they need to have these really high resolution rates, like crime resolution rates. So they'll do things like they declare what looks like to be a murder, they declare it a suicide. And so it goes away, right? Because the person is a suicide. And the family gets angry and they riot and people come in and they riot with them because they themselves have experienced the effects of this poor policing. And that's what I'm really trying to quantify in my next project, because it's definitely clearly an issue and it's something that the ministry is thinking about. But because, again, of limited resources, it does not look like — I've got another project that looks at police reform under Xi Jinping, and I thought, well, let's see if there's any real reform to low policing, the crime control that we're talking about, versus the high policing, the stability maintenance work. And they just — you go through the reform documents, you talk to ministry officials, they're still prioritizing stability maintenance. They're not prioritizing, right? It's just let's head this off at the point where it erupts. Let's try to stop that protest without actually addressing the underlying cause. Is the underlying reasons for people's dissatisfaction and frustration and anger.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up your next projects, which is where I want to go next. But before I do, what are the implications for your study? I mean, this is remarkable understanding. Is this new? Was this new to political scientists? Is it new to China scholars? Say just a little bit about how your book kind of changes what we know as scholars about Chinese policing, and also what the implications are for the state of China that this is the case going forward. Is this something that in other cases we know comparatively mm-hmm. can lead to a problem, and what kind of problem?
Yeah, so this is definitely it was a surprising finding. It wasn't what I thought would be uncovered when I started the project, and that's kind of important, because typically when we look at the different types of Chinese bureaucracies, we think that the police are doing a pretty good job. Right, this is where they've got some more resources. They've got the guns. They're fairly effective, and so to find out that actually they're not effective, and they're when it's decentralized, like, things get worse. Right, when it's centralized and it's protest control, like the state gets the outcomes that it desires. But when it's decentralized and the local forces are essentially left to cope without all the resources and training, things are bad. This has implications for how other bureaucracies in China are functioning, and particularly because this is bad for so many different groups, right? So it's bad for people. Under-policing, over-policing is bad for people. Under-policing is also bad for people. If you can't trust the police to come when you call and you know, at least attempt to solve your problem, that's really an issue. Right, like if they're not making reports, if they're classifying a murder as a suicide, if they're, you know, in one example, I had in an interview, it came out that a woman had her house broken into, and the officer, you know, as long as she would call back to the station and say that it was a mistake, that everything was okay, then he would fix her lock for free. But he wasn't going to make a report. He wasn't going to do anything else. But he'd fix her lock if she'll call back, so that it doesn't get reported and he doesn't have to go through the paperwork. That's not good for the public, right? That's not good. You expect police to do the job of providing security, and if something goes wrong, to show up and try to address your concern. It's also bad for the police, right? They're stressed. They're overworked. These stations are grossly understaffed. They've got, you know, more and more cases, more and more expectations. All of these cameras that have been going out, and the body cameras, that's just adding more work without the additional training that they have to analyze the footage, right, that's coming in. The older officers aren't even permitted to try to figure these things out. The new technology, it's put on younger officers, and so it's bad. This is why we're seeing those adverse health effects, and it's not good for the state either. I mean, ultimately, if police ineffectiveness is feeding back into protests, then that has implications for regime instability. And we've seen, you know, in other areas where policing has just gotten, you know, much worse than it is in China, because certainly if you look in other parts of the world, you see policing that is far more inefficient and ineffective. People's regime preferences change. So in Latin America, there's studies where they found that people actually prefer more authoritarian styles of governance because they don't feel safe, they don't feel secure. So this has really, you know, broad sweeping implications. This is not just about a couple of officers being unhappy. This is about a country that has a policing problem that, to be quite frank, has only gotten worse during COVID, because now, on top of everything else that they were expected to do, they also have to police people with their quarantine situation and their masking. And so, again, another project I have is looking at these attacks against the police, where people just get so frustrated and at these additional responsibilities the police have had to take on during COVID.
Okay, so let's talk about your new research in two ways. First, you know, you've mentioned a couple of projects, so lay out how, you know, are they articles? Are they separate or related? Is this another book project? But also, how do you think you can now do research in China? And you know, and I want to ask you a little bit also about being, you know, a PIP fellow and what that has looked like under COVID. And actually, let me ask that first. So, you know, one of the ideas of the PIP program is to connect, you know, good scholarship in a variety of areas, not just political science, with the public, and to, you know, to travel to China, right? The PIP people have normally brought staffers, congressional staffers, to especially people who have never been to China, and they've gone and they've spent time and they've gone to offices and they've met people and they've hung out with people like you and others for an extended period of time so that they can bring back to Congress a fuller, richer, more nuanced understanding of this complicated country that plays such an important role in global politics and American foreign policy. So putting the new research on hold for just a second, what does it look like right now for you to be a PIP fellow and performing this role and not being able to travel to China?
So I think that the mission of the National Council and the mission of the PIP program is important now more than ever for so many reasons. We're in this dark period, right? And it's not just COVID. Lots of research agendas have been upended by COVID, but it's the regime under Xi Jinping, and it's the restrictions on scholarly access. And there'll be some projects that people can continue. And you know, my research on policing cannot continue in the former form. And so, you know, part of the thing that you know, I'm grappling with, that other people in the PIP program are also grappling with, is how do we continue to shape that narrative, right? Because we can't go to China. There is a China trip. It is on hold. We hope that if anyone can do it, then the National Council can, the National Committee can do it. But we don't know. We don't know if we'll be able to go at any point in the future. But the thing that we can do is to go to DC, right? The thing that we can do is to travel the country and to write op-eds and to put ourselves out there and put our research out there and try to shape that narrative. Because just as China has closed, the United States has really, the Congress and other people in the policy community have decided that China is the bad guy, and that the only thing that we're going to have bipartisan cooperation on is China, and working against China and trying to strengthen ourselves against China. And that's very unnuanced, right? Like that is a very sort of Cold War mentality that I don't want to see become a reality. That others, other scholars, particular people who are thinking about their profile as public intellectuals, that they don't want to see happen. Many of them, we want to make sure that policy is being guided by an accurate understanding of China. And so, if you think, from my perspective, the security perspective, if you think of China as this all-knowing police state that has cameras everywhere and it's Big Brother and they can control everything, that's just not accurate, right? Like that's not the reality on the ground. That's not, even with the advances that they've been able to make, that's never going to be the case. I've had ministry officials tell me, like, it's just from their perspective, the criminals are always going to be one step ahead. Right, because they have access to even better technology and even better teams, right, than people in the ministry do, and so that is a limitation, right? And when we're painting China as this all powerful, all knowing entity, that's incorrect, and it ends up having people be fearful, right, and driving policy, and so I think now more than ever we have to talk about that. China looks like a lot of other states, right? That there are these inefficiencies and that things aren't working the way that we think they're working. And that should hopefully make people understand that it's not, the capacity is not endless, right? And hopefully that will, for some people, help shape policy and help shape decisions and help them back off a bit, right? And to hopefully again in the future travel to China and have those connections, like have those human to human interactions that are so crucial for understanding and for de-escalating, right? De-escalating the rhetoric, making us better allies, even if it has to be some sort of new terminology, right? Not the traditional Cold War adversaries, but something that is more collaborative.
So tell us a little bit about these. I think I counted three different projects that you're currently working on, and whether there are three streams or they're all part of a book project.
Because I can't go to China and do interviews any longer, I had a second book project that was planned to do more interviews with the public, to do focus groups. And finally, about maybe 9 months ago, I just said, okay, this is not going to happen. And in the interim, fortunately, I've been doing a lot of methods retraining. I've been getting into natural language processing, and I'm going to field a survey experiment next month, thinking about how do we get at China when we can't go to China. And to be honest, that's opened up a whole realm of possible research projects. So I've reconfigured the second book manuscript, which is, I call it Constructing State Legitimacy in China, looking at the public's reaction to policing and poor policing, and also to the strategies that the Ministry of Public Security is pursuing to try to shape that public opinion. So they put a lot of money, a lot of effort into TV specials, into social media, particularly Douyin or TikTok. And so I'm tracking all of this online to understand what this new propaganda looks like, right? And how it's reaching people. And you can still field surveys, online surveys from a distance. And you can analyze the text that people are writing. And that's for me, that's going to be the path going forward, because I don't want to leave policing. I still feel like there's so much to say. It's changing. So someone needs to be doing this work. I want to be doing this work, but the methods have to change, right? You have to look at you have to look at comments on police videos, right? And I've got another data set that I've put together of these attacks against the police, where people are engaging in these sort of low profile conflicts, right? Where they're engaging in acts of violence against police officers, and it's remaining online, and it's this kind of material that remains available and accessible for researchers. And we just, I think, as a field, particularly for those of us who work on these very sensitive topics, we have to get smart about our methods and get creative and think about how do we continue to pursue these questions of interest and what does that look like and how do we make it a reality?
Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for taking time out in this part of the semester to talk to us. I've been talking to Suzanne Scoggins about Policing China, Street-Level Cops in the Shadow of Protests, published by Cornell University Press in 2021.
Thank you, Susan.